This is WCSX Online. Our live web stream begins in 15 seconds.
Hi, this is Brian Elias, president of 1-800-HANSONS. Enter our exciting home makeover sweepstakes by clicking on the banner above. You can win the home improvement of your dreams. Windows, siding, roofing, doors, gutter protection. Come on, you can win. Get it done.
That in the long run, economic disparities are bound to increase. But in the short to medium term, yes, they do increase. There should be a constant effort, and that is often missing because of the change in values. A human being needs not be just an economic van. A human being should remain human being. And economic means are only a vehicle to provide material things which are needed. If India goes back to Mahatma Gandhi's philosophy, which is rooted, by the way, in thousands of years of old Indian philosophy, spirituality and culture, Mahatma Gandhi's contribution was in bringing those things in forefront of our Indian society and world at large, such as simple living, high thinking.
Or I can see that in the midst of death, life persists. In the midst of untruth, truth persists. In the midst of darkness, light persists.
There is a core of, I've heard figures around 400 million people who still live a village life that is relatively unconnected to modern India. There is a strong traditional sense of community in those villages that has been lost in many of the cities where industrialization and technology have moved in. Is it possible to overcome poverty without destroying community in the process, which is, after all, another kind of wealth?
My answer is yes. Now, whether, Mark, you say, will it be in my lifetime? You know, I am already 72. That I cannot say. I think we have to work with this theme that modernity is not bad in itself. Globalization is not bad in itself, but we must remain conscious towards our social responsibility. We should be aware India's problem is not caused by illiterate people. The moral standards, in my personal experience, of illiterate people is higher than the educated people. In the process of modernization, or Pandit Nehru's, India's first prime minister's vision, morality was lost. We completely drifted away. That's the real challenge before us, how to blend the two. And what we are trying at the grassroots level is to rebuild India, modern India, but not Western India. There is a vast stream, sages or saints or spiritual leaders who are trying to inculcate those ancient values with modernity. These people are educated. They travel worldwide. So it is not that they don't know what the modern world is. No, they are not engrossed in materialism. They have a different vision rooted in Indian soil. I think that definitely gives us a ray of hope. It is possible to have harmony between modernization and human values.
Dr. Vinod Prakash. After a short break, Mexican economist Miguel Picar.
Rich man or rich man, a rich man, don't care about the poor man. The poor man, they have to stand strong. If you don't get money, you ain't got no friends.
You're listening to A World of Possibilities, a production of the Mainstream Media Project. For more information about this and other programs, and to access the full interviews with some of our guests, please visit our website at aworldofpossibilities.com.
The poor woman, have a baby
Like India, Mexico has experienced both the upsides and downsides of economic globalization. For some, it's been a boon. For others, a bane. The southern Mexican state of Chiapas has always been poor. Home to the indigenous descendants of the Mayan people, it's also the site where the Zapatista peasant movement burst forth into the international spotlight in the 1990s. As director of the Center for Political and Economic Research for Community Action, Miguel Picard daily observes the ground-level consequences of the growing gap between rich and poor. He joins us from his office in San Cristobal de las Casas, capital of the state of Chiapas. What do you see when you look at the trends of a growing gap between rich and the poor worldwide, and I imagine in Mexico as well? How does that impact a place like Chiapas that has been in some ways outside the national and global economy for centuries, really?
The tendencies in Chiapas pretty much reflect the tendencies worldwide. There is very definitely a growing divide between rich and poor, and we can see this on a number of levels. There is an increase in poverty. There is a widening gap between the very, very few people who have really too much and the immense majority who have basically nothing. And the tendencies, unfortunately, are not being reverted. We have been in the throes of neoliberalism for the past 20 years. We used to talk about the 80s being the lost decade in Latin America, but actually for most of the countries in our region, it's now been two decades of a failure to grow, of a failure to attend to the needs of the poor.
Give us a sense of how this growing poverty is reflected in the lives of people in Chiapas. Are these people who are living on a dollar a day or less, or are they living in a largely non-cash economy?
We're talking about people who are trying to get by rather unsuccessfully on $2 a day or less. That's extreme poverty, and I think that's the measure that is generally used by even the World Bank. What we can see, a very specific tendency in the state of Chiapas, is for a tremendous upsurge in the last 5 to 7 years in out-migration. Chiapas did not used to be an expelling state. It is now. We now are one of the principal expelling states in Mexico, of people leaving the state and moving to the big cities in Mexico, but the growing tendency, or the tendency that's growing the most, is to head towards the United States.
Well, when there is this kind of pressure and desperation on the one hand to break out of poverty and head towards the wealthy nations, and at the same time the wealthy nations try to close the door, are we building up here a kind of a pressure cooker that at some point could result in some larger form of civil disturbance around the world than even what we see now?
Yeah, it looks like there is a pressure being built up. The unfortunate thing is that since the start of neoliberalism in the beginning of the 80s, everything has been liberalized, the flow of capital across borders, the flow of goods, but the flow of people is still very much restricted. And labor, people, are a factor in production, just like technology and capital, etc. Why is everything liberalized except labor? Why are these policies implemented that seem to benefit only large business concerns to the detriment of the poor?
When you look at this outflow from home communities all over the developing world and people flooding into super cities and in trying to enter wealthy countries, how do you reverse that flow? It seems like you need to reinvest in those communities in one way or another, or at least rebalance the marketplace so that it is actually a fair market rather than a market that through subsidies becomes fixed in one direction.
What is the development model at this point? We don't have any. The government cannot favor a one direction over another because that's specifically prohibited by the free trade agreements, by the World Trade Organization, etc. So what development model does a government have at this point? Well, here in this country, there is no development model. It's just simply opening up the doors to foreign capital, and it's foreign capital, foreign multinational corporations who get to do whatever they want. So whatever they do, that's the development model. But if they should decide to pick up and leave, like precisely what's happening in Mexico at this point, the maquiladoras, the plants on the northern border, have been closing and they've been moving to China. Where does that leave Mexico? Well, it leaves it in a very terrible situation because there is no way to industrialize the country. Industrialization historically has been the way for poor countries to move up that mountain, to move closer to the summit. It's the way that the countries at the top got to be where they are. But you can't do that in an ambiance of total free market conditions.
Well, is it really free market?
Well, no, it's not. The rules say it should be, but then who gets to fudge the rules? Well, the rich, powerful countries. I mean, we go back to the story of subsidies in the United States. The United States should not be granting billion-dollar subsidies to agribusiness concerns. That's specifically prohibited by World Trade Organization legislation, by the free trade agreements that the United States has signed with Mexico, with Canada, and with other countries. Yet because the United States is so powerful, it can do whatever it wants. So no, it calls for free trade when it's talking to other countries, but when it refers to what's happening back home, there's a very, very different story to be heard.
What do we need to do, and who needs to do it, given that those who currently dictate the economic rules are among the wealthiest nations?
We have to look at the World Trade Organization. We have to look at the World Bank. We have to look very definitely at the International Monetary Fund. You know, these are organizations that are totally undemocratic, not the least bit transparent. It's very, very difficult for concerned citizens, for activists, to get information before decisions are taken. The galling thing is that these institutions make decisions that affect millions of people, and yet they are accountable to virtually no one. And as a matter of fact, we take even a more radical stand, and we actually call for these institutions to be abolished, not for there to be nothing left in their place, but rather for something quite different, quite new, much more representative, much more democratic to be created in their place.
Why don't you describe what that new architecture of global finance would look like?
We need to obviously have world institutions that can tackle the global problems of today and in the near future. The problem is, with the present institutions, they are closed and work with a certain ideological line. Again, we would point to neoliberalism as their guiding ideology, which favors privatization, favors the government from to step aside and let the free market make the major economic decisions. But when we're looking at these world problems, we can't always trust the market to make the right decision.
The WTO has come in for a lot of criticism from anti-globalization activists. Is there any way in which pressures on it from a broader public could actually enable it to become some kind of positive force instead of the negative force they believe it is now?
If we're talking about attending to the enormous poverty in the planet, we have to look at actually unfair trade. We have to look at how countries at the very top of that developmental summit, how they got there. We have to go back and look at the way the rules that worked for those countries, and we have to say, okay, there may be also a case for some countries being able to decide autonomously what needs to be protected within the economy. Total open trade, total open borders is a recipe for disaster for poor countries that have basically no infrastructure and no industry or very weak industry. We're talking about, what, 4 billion people out of 6 billion people that are poor. We have to look at that world problem. The present situation is not sustainable. if you look at the alternative, I think it's an alternative that we really wouldn't want to carry into the future. It's an unsustainable alternative. The United States is, in the case of its neighbors, paying the price, if you will, of failed economic policies. The neoliberal policies have just simply not worked, not only not in Mexico, but not in Latin America. And this is generating pressures on its southern border. Is that a moral argument or an argument towards compassion? I think it's just looking out for the best interests of the world in general. The wealthy nations are the ones that are creating the unfair trade rules. The wealthy nations are favoring their multinational corporations at the expense of 700,000 cotton farmers in Africa, 15 million people who depend on the growing of corn in Mexico. What is the alternative? The alternative is the pressure cooker situation that you referred to before. We have to look at ways of decreasing world poverty, and it takes the participation of all countries.
Mexican economist Miguel Picar. I'm Mark Sommer, and this is A World of Possibilities, distributed by the WFMT Radio Network.
Digital audio on your desktop.
Computers can do that?
The Classic Rock Web Stream from 94.7 WCSX.
Your game, drive me insane, trouble's gonna come to
WCSX Classic Rock Webstream.
Spin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, George Bush's choice of Robert Gates to replace Donald Rumsfeld as defense secretary is being portrayed in the media as a sensible choice, part of a White House turn to more pragmatic policies and advisors in the wake of GOP congressional defeats. But in his report, The Secret World of Robert Gates, investigative reporter Robert Perry of ConsortiumNews.com sees Gates differently. Robert Perry will join us to talk about the Gates nomination. Also on Counterspin today, in 2003, Dixie Chick singer Natalie Maines declared on stage in London that she was ashamed that George W. Bush was from Texas. The campaign against the group that followed was astonishing. Radio stations banned the group's music, pundits lined up to denounce them for speaking out on the eve of war, and all the while defenders of free speech were left wondering where it would all end. A new documentary takes us back to those days. Barbara Koppel spoke with Counterspin's Janine Jackson about her film, Shut Up and Sing, and how things have changed and haven't in the last 3 years. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
After 12 years of being out of power in Congress, Democratic politicians might have believed that there was little they could do to generate media interest in their ideas. It was revealing then to read one New York Times reporter confirm the worst assumptions about how Beltway reporters work. Times reporter Carl Hulse wrote in the November 19th edition of the paper, quote, "For years, reporters have crowded the Republican end of the Speaker's lobby off the House floor, buttonholing majority lawmakers who ran the place and virtually ignoring the opposite end, where somewhat irrelevant Democrats came and went with little notice," close quote. Hulse noted that since the tables have turned, now reporters are swarming the Democrats. Such behavior is, at the very least, pathetic, since it assumes that the important stories are going to come from hanging around the folks who wield all the power. If anything, the opposite is more likely to be true, especially with a Republican Congress so unwilling to challenge the executive branch. In the March 2005 issue of Harper's Magazine, editor Lewis Lapham spoke to several prominent Democrats about how they'd been effectively shut out of the legislative process by the Republican majority, reduced to filing lawsuits to get documents from the White House, or holding unofficial hearings into matters like the Downing Street memos, Social Security privatization, Halliburton's actions in Iraq, and so on. As the Democrats told Lapham, their only chance was that the media would do its part and report on what they were up to. It's a long shot for sure, and reports such as this one in the Times only confirm that sad fact.
Senator Trent Lott's return to the ranks of the Senate Republican leadership has been broadly covered as a story of political redemption. Lott's 2002 praise for the late Strom Thurmond's segregationist 1948 presidential candidacy led to his ouster as Senate Majority Leader, but, to hear the media tell it, Lott has apologized, atoned for his sins, and found redemption in his election to the number two Republican post of Minority Whip. On October 16th, an Associated Press article took the headline Sweet Redemption, and a front-page New York Times report similarly called Lott's story an unlikely study in professional redemption. Many reports saw Lott's remark as a judgment problem rather than a racism problem, characterizing them as ill-considered, infelicitous, racially impolitic, and tasteless. Vocal enthusiasm for an openly racist campaign suggests a bigger problem than poor taste, certainly, but much of the coverage gave no inkling that Lott's record of racism amounts to more than one isolated incident. Beyond largely ignoring Lott's voting record, he consistently opposed the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, and a national holiday for Martin Luther King, for example, no mainstream media outlet seems to have reported that Trent Lott has never come close to apologizing for his long-term association with the Council of Conservative Citizens, a racist group the Southern Poverty Law Center described as the reincarnation of the infamous white citizens' councils of the 1950s and 1960s. In late 1998, when that link surfaced, Lott denied any detailed knowledge of the group. In fact, Lott had hosted CCC leaders in his Senate office in 1997 and addressed its events at least three times throughout the 1990s. As a keynote speaker at a 1992 CCC convention, Lott heaped praise on its members. Quote, "The people in this room stand for the right principles and the right philosophy." Close quote. This earlier racism scandal was widely reported at the time, but in just a few short years has been swept down the media memory hole, neatly clearing the path for Lott's unreconstructed redemption.
Things haven't been going well for George W. Bush lately, and while there might be a tendency in the press corps to kick an unpopular president while he's down, there's also plenty of evidence of the opposite. Consider Time Magazine's Mike Allen's words about Bush's trip to Vietnam in the November 27th issue of the magazine. The trip, wrote Allen, quote, allowed him to look commanding, even regal, at a time when post-election Washington is buzzing about the onrushing twilight of his presidency, close quote. Translation, the folks back home don't think much of you, Mr. President, but I sure do. Allen did Bush another favor later in the piece when he recounted a pretty embarrassing Bush gaffe. Visiting the site where John McCain's plane went down during the Vietnam War, Bush spoke about how McCain, who was, remember, held as a prisoner of war, was, quote, literally saved in one way by the people pulling him out, close quote. Allen gently added that McCain was kicked, hit, and bayoneted as he was pulled from a lake. Allen closed with this peculiar note, quote, aides admitted later that the president's telling, although accurate, was incomplete, close quote. Allen did not explain how those comments from Bush were either commanding or regal.
Who made the monumentally poor decision to have O.J. Simpson publish a book and appear on two TV specials to talk about how he would have killed his wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend Ronald Goldman, if he had done it? Who had the unimaginable bad taste to put the victim's loved ones through a book and TV show version of the 1994 murders all over again? The answers are easy. Rupert Murdoch's News Corp owns the publishing company, Reagan Books, which announced the publication of the book, If I Did It, and Fox Broadcasting, which scheduled the TV shows featuring interviews of Simpson by Judith Reagan, the publisher of Reagan Books. Among the tens of millions who thought the Simpson enterprise was a really bad idea was Fox News Channel's Bill O'Reilly. Proving the old adage about a stopped clock still being right twice a day, O'Reilly repeatedly bashed News Corp's OJ plans. Each time, though, O'Reilly took pains to say that Fox Broadcasting had, quote, nothing to do with Fox News Channel, close quote. O'Reilly's point was untrue. Rupert Murdoch's News Corp owns the Fox News Channel, as well as Fox Broadcasting and Reagan Books. And Fox News Channel and Fox Broadcast TV operations are both run by Murdoch Lieutenant Roger Ailes. So it must have been confusing to O'Reilly, if to no one else, when, on November 20th, his boss, Rupert Murdoch, responded to the public outcry by apologizing to the families of the murdered and canceling the OJ book and TV specials.
And finally, remember that joke John Kerry told right before the midterm elections when he tried to mock George W. Bush's intelligence? You probably do. You also probably think by now there are more important things to talk about. But you're not Fox News host Chris Wallace, who interviewed Kerry on the November 19th broadcast of Fox News Sunday. Kerry probably knew he was in for it when Wallace told him this, quote, "We told you before you came on that we were going to talk some about the joke. I agree there's things to talk about after, but there are questions people have, and I'm going to ask you about them, sir," close quote. Wallace took a similar line with Bill Clinton a few months back when he decided that the people really wanted to know why Clinton hadn't, to borrow Wallace's phrase, put Al-Qaeda out of business while he was president. Nonetheless, Kerry's joke-telling really was far more important to Wallace than those other subjects he alluded to. By our count, Wallace posed 10 questions about the joke, a grand total of 3 about other issues. For the record, Wallace took a much different approach to his other guest, Republican heavyweight Newt Gingrich, who, like Kerry, is a contender for the White House in 2008. But Wallace didn't quiz Gingrich about all the things about his past that might make it hard for him to win the Republican nomination. Apparently, those types of questions are reserved for Democrats like Kerry.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch group, FAIR. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show. George Bush's nomination of former CIA Director Robert Gates to replace outgoing Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has been greeted with general approval in the media. In a column for Time magazine, Walter Isaacson called Gates soft-spoken and clear-minded and argued George Bush was heading in a more sensible direction by turning to his father's inner circle for advice and appointments, including that of Robert Gates. Our guest, Robert Perry, sees Gates' nomination from a different angle, writing that Gates, quote, has long faced accusations of collaborating with Islamic extremists in Iran, arming Saddam Hussein's dictatorship in Iraq, and politicizing U.S. intelligence to conform with the desires of policymakers, three key areas that relate to his future job, close quote. Robert Perry joins us now by phone from Virginia. Robert Perry, welcome back to Counterspin.
Well, thanks for having me.
A New York Times profile of Robert Gates on November 19th portrayed him as a sort of smart, low-key manager with a fondness for the Boy Scouts and Texas A&M football, but it breezed lightly over some of the low points in Gates' career. Tell us what the Times left out, and let's begin with the Iran-Contra scandal.
Well, Gates was in the middle of the whole mess, both in terms of setting up the intelligence that became the basis for allowing the Reagan administration to begin shipping weapons to Iran in 1985-86. He was also involved in providing some of the testimony which turned out to be false to Congress, writing it for CIA Director William Casey. Many of his subordinates and other people at the agency felt that he knew a lot more than he was letting on. And that's how the Congress also felt. When he first was put up for CIA Director in 87, he was forced to withdraw because of these doubts. And independent counsel Lawrence Walsh pursued the Iran-Contra investigation, essentially concluded that Gates had been deceiving both the grand jury and Congress in his statements, but just didn't have enough evidence to bring an indictment. So Gates was a person who both was involved in a very unsavory policy, but also was involved in doing a cover-up of that policy.
Remind us what the Iraq-Gate scandal was. That's a different scandal than the Iran-Contra scandal, and what Gates' role in it was.
Well, they're interconnected. There was a war that was going on between Iran and Iraq starting in 1980 and going on for 8 years. Secretly, the United States was supporting both sides of the conflict. There'd be a tilt to Iran. Weapons would be allowed to flow that way. Then there'd be a tilt to Iraq where the U.S. would help Saddam Hussein get more materiel to carry out his side of the war. So Gates, according to various documents, was implicated in both elements of this strange policy that was being conducted. And he was, according to Howard Teicher, who was a former NSC official under Ronald Reagan, Gates played a key role in implementing the Iraq side of this policy as well.
In a piece that you once wrote for Extra, for Fares magazine, you told how Gates actually had a role in providing cluster bombs to Iraq, Saddam Hussein's Iraq.
Right. Basically, the Bush 1 administration denied most of it, and Gates was among those denying it. The evidence, however, pointed to a great deal of involvement by the Bush 1 administration with Iraq. And then in 1995, there was a criminal case brought against a company that had been involved in helping this Chilean arms manufacturer produce cluster bombs for Iraq. And in the context of that case, Howard Teicher, the NSC staffer, submitted a sworn affidavit which described the role of Casey and Gates in helping to facilitate these shipments from Chile to Iraq.
Well, the Gates nomination makes you sort of wonder if George Bush couldn't find a defense secretary, I mean, Rumsfeld and Gates, who didn't help Saddam Hussein during the 1980s. In an interview with Democracy Now! In 2004, you said, quote, the analytical division of the CIA was virtually destroyed during that period of the 1980s under Bill Casey and Robert Gates, close quote. You were talking about how Casey and his deputy Robert Gates exaggerated the threats posed by countries like the Soviet Union and Nicaragua. Explain how that would be relevant to Gates' new job.
Well, Gates became the head of the analytical division in the early 1980s under Casey. One of his jobs was to sort of bring the, especially the Soviet division, the famed Soviet division of CIA, into line with administration policy, which was to hype the strength of the Soviet Union. That may seem odd, but the basic idea was that if the intelligence said that the Soviet Union had a booming economy and its technology was going well and that it could perform aggressively militarily, that would justify arms buildups in the United States and a more aggressive policy in the Third World against the Soviet surrogates. So that's what Gates essentially had the intelligence division produce. And many of the analysts opposed this and tried to stop it. But Gates was able to drive many of them out of the CIA, or at least punish them. So over time, this idea of objective analysis informing policy rather than policy allowing the transformation of intelligence, it kind of got reversed the wrong way. And the people that Gates put in to carry out this politicization of the CIA intelligence stayed on. Even after Gates left in 1993, many of his hires, people he promoted, remained in place really up through the current Bush administration. And they were there when another round of politicization went through, which was to exaggerate the threats from Iraq in terms of their weapons of mass destruction. So there's a continuum here of what Gates had been doing with the CIA in the 1980s to what's happened with the Iraq War.
Well, there's some suggestion that Bush may try to appoint Gates without confirmation hearings through a recess appointment. But what questions do you think Gates should have to face whether or not there are confirmation hearings?
Well, it would make logical sense to ask these questions and get serious answers, not just bland denials, but to really dig into some of this. Did Gates take part in the Iraq Gate operations as Teicher describes? And others have described the same thing, too. It's not just Teicher. What was Gates' real role in the Iran shipments of arms, which, according to some documentary evidence and witnesses, goes back even to 1980 when the Republican campaign was trying to unseat Jimmy Carter? What was Gates' role in terms of politicization of intelligence? And really, and has he learned those lessons? But it's certainly the questions relating to his involvement with foreign activities should be resolved before he gets confirmed, because these are not secrets and information you want lying out there when someone has to perform a job like Defense Secretary of the United States. If hostile foreign powers might have evidence that Gates was lying, that could be something that could be used to influence his decision-making.
And speaking of confirmation hearings, even those senators who opposed Gates in earlier confirmation hearings say they'll vote for him this time around. There seems to be sort of a lack of debate at all about this.
Well, I think people, especially on the Democratic side, are so happy with the idea of getting rid of Donald Rumsfeld that they're willing to sort of accept this trade-off, where President Bush wants this old supporter of his father to be put in as defense secretary. And Gates probably is more of a practical person than Rumsfeld turned out to be. So I think some of the commentary about Gates is not inaccurate. He's a fairly smart guy who probably will bring a certain amount of even-keel approach to the Defense Department. But that still doesn't fully explain what his roles were in some of these very controversial operations. But I think you have the Democrats thinking that, well, if the deal is to get rid of Rumsfeld, we'll take Gates.
We've been speaking with Robert Perry, the publisher of ConsortiumNews.com, where you can read his report, The Secret World of Robert Gates. Robert Perry, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
In 2003, singer Natalie Maines of the group The Dixie Chicks told a London audience, hours before a massive demonstration opposing the invasion of Iraq, that she was ashamed that George W. Bush was from Texas. The response to Maines' comment became an orchestrated campaign from some right-wing corners. An effort was made to get radio stations to ban the best-selling group's records, and it all became a prime example of the wave of jingoistic censorship and the willing abandonment of principles of free expression and debate that so marked the beginning of the Iraq War. A new film traces the Dixie Chicks and the public's navigation of that period. It's called Shut Up and Sing, and it comes from documentary filmmaker Barbara Koppel, along with co-director Cecilia Peck. Barbara Koppel has made many award-winning films, including Harlan County, USA, and American Dream. She joins us now by phone. Barbara Koppel, welcome to Counterspin.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, many of us watched with dismay and almost a kind of amazement as the aggressive reaction to Natalie Maines' statement of opinion became this huge campaign against her and the group. I wonder, were you thinking as it happened that this might be worthy subject matter, or did that come after?
Well, we wanted to make, Cecilia Peck and I wanted to make a film before the comment was made. We thought that the Dixie Chicks were pretty interesting. Songs like Goodbye Earl, where they talked about domestic violence, and their musicality was incredible. But they had a website group that they went on tour with for Top of the World, and so we were told, nah, there doesn't need to be a documentary made on us. What we say isn't very important. And then Natalie made the comment, and there was no way we were not going to do this film. So we kept pestering the Dixie Chicks, and finally they consented, and we were able to go for it.
Well, were you surprised at any point? You've seen a lot, I think it's fair to say. Were you surprised by the scale of the attack on this group?
Oh, it was incredible, the scale of the attack on this group. I mean, the Dixie Chicks, as we know, come out of country music, and country music sometimes is very conservative, and they put you in a box, and they probably never expected in their wildest dreams that these all-American girls would make any kind of statement that was detrimental to the policy of the United States. So country music felt betrayed by the Dixie Chicks. There was a huge campaign by a group called the Free Republic that sent out, you know, 30,000 emails to people, put them on their blog, on the internet, so that the Dixie Chicks were boycotted, their CDs were crushed, and they had a death threat in June of 2003.
Nothing like seeing the actual physical destruction of products of art to really give you that chill. But does it also say something about the state of radio today, about that landscape, that this even could happen?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting, the kind of control that radio and the media conglomerates who are responsible for silencing the Dixie Chicks have. Simon Renshaw, who is the Dixie Chicks manager, was on C-SPAN. And he was on with a man named Louis Dickey, who was from Cumulus Broadcasting. And even Republican John McCain was outraged at this situation, mm-hmm. in which the Dixie Chicks' music was totally stopped, the kind of control where individual stations are expected to fall in line, which, as Senator McCain sort of talks, is, you know, is a direct contradiction, because they say, oh, well, every radio station is free to do what they want, and then Mr. Dickey says, no, but they all fell in line. And so there is a total control over this.
Well, some of the story, I guess, in light of that is about the fans and the people who didn't abandon the band despite being essentially ordered to, so it's not all depressing in that regard.
Well, I mean, I think none of it is depressing. I think that it's very frightening. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, the film is a very human story. It's a story about personal and political transformation and courage and what it means to be a hero in that day and age where reporters couldn't even say what was happening in Iraq, and we had sort of this cowboy mentality of, you know, you're either with us or against us. And for the Dixie Chicks to stand up, to speak out, even though they were boycotted and silenced, is hope, because it also allowed them to then be free and to be liberated, to be the kind of musicians that they wanted to be, because nobody was playing them, so nobody cared as far as they were concerned. So they were able to write their own music, and they wrote about issues that they cared about. And it's the first time they ever did that, whether it was infertility or love or politics. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, it really allowed them to grow into their own skin.
Well, and for those of us who might feel that that chill has abated or might want to take that hope, I wonder what kind of reaction you have to the fact that in this day and age, NBC refused to carry ads for Shut Up and Sing on the grounds that, as they said in writing, the ads are disparaging to President Bush.
Yeah, I mean, we were just absolutely appalled, because in a sense, this film is a film about censorship,
right,
and about freedom of speech. And then our ad has been censored by NBC and CW. And it just goes to show that we're living in a time when our rights are truly in danger. And everyone from artists to everyday people have cause for concern. And that's why it's so important to speak up. Because if we don't, we're going to lose the rights that we take for granted. They did show the ads after much pressure, so that worked, but it taught a phenomenal lesson about the atmosphere that we have out there and about fear and about censorship.
Well, let me ask you, Barbara Koppel, what you make of the criticism that I've heard in some corners that, you know, coal miners, for example, they really need somebody to speak for them. But the Dixie Chicks, they're a big band. They have a platform. They've got plenty of avenues to tell their story. What's your reaction to that as kind of a critique of this project?
I think that all of us need to speak for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And coal miners, like the Dixie Chicks, in a way, have an incredible bond. When they're in the coal mines, when it's dangerous, they come out and they strike and they have each other's backs. And the Dixie Chicks and the people who support them and all of us who care about them, one of the most profound pieces and themes of the film is about friendship and about how, as times get hard, that bond just grows deeper and how they had each other's backs. And so I don't think that we can separate any group from each other. I think that we all need to be supported when it's time to stand up and not back down from the things that you feel are right.
We've been speaking with filmmaker Barbara Koppel, director with Cecilia Peck of the new film Shut Up and Sing. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
That's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure to tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. You can also listen to Counterspin at FAIR's website at www.fair.org. This show was engineered at Mercer Media by Kelly Spivey and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Streaming audio from your classic rock home in cyberspace. 94.7 WCSX. Classic Rock Web Stream.
Information overload.
From 94.7 WCSX.
announced at a gala ceremony next April in Detroit during the Society of Automotive Engineers Conference. For a complete listing of Automotive News PACE Award finalists, visit autonews.com/PACE.
Men have rights. Men have rights, period. This is Eric Paisner, president of FREP, Fathers Rights for Equality in Divorce, a law firm exclusively representing men in divorce and family law matters. If you're contemplating going through a divorce, currently going through a divorce, or have other family law issues, call us today at 248-356-7775. We continue to successfully represent men in divorce and family law matters throughout southeastern Michigan. You don't have to lose your home, your children, your business, or your retirement. Call today at 248-356-7775. A lawyer is available 7 days a week to answer your questions. FREP, Fathers Rights for Equality in Divorce, the best answer for men in divorce and family law. Call today at 248-356-7775. And let FREP protect your rights.
Nothing is more important than knowing your legal rights. Call the experts at FREP, Fathers Rights for Equality in Divorce, 248-356-7775.
I can go right to that counter, and there's just going to be a tremendous selection. Not only selection, but unique pieces that you don't see everywhere.
That's Jared, the Galleria of Jewelry customer, Larry Yone.
Their selection of gold jewelry is very nice. What I like about gold is, to me, it symbolizes permanence. It symbolizes beauty. I give my wife gold because I know that it makes her feel special.
This holiday, we'll make sure you get the perfect gift of gold, because from classic to contemporary, only Jared offers 5 times the selection of truly distinctive gold jewelry. Why settle when you can select?
I can tell her that I love her, but when I give her that little box and she opens it up, actions speak louder than words.
Jared has more choices in yellow, white, and pink gold. And with prices from under $50 to over $1,000, gold makes the moment shine. Get a preview at Jared.com.
It can only be Jared.
Jared on Baldwin Road in Auburn Hills, across from 12 Oaks in Novi, in Utica at M59 and the Van Dyke Expressway, and across from Oakland Mall in Troy.